Hey everyone, thanks for checking out another podcast. I'm glad today to have my friend Brian Burkhart with me. We're going to talk about the documentation of police-related deaths in the United States. So when someone dies, whether that be they're shot by the police, they're involved in a traffic accident while fleeing from the police, they commit suicide to avoid being taken into police custody, all of these types of deaths, how they're documented in the United States and how they're not documented in the United States. He's the creator of a database called Fatal Encounters, and what they try to do is document every police-related death since the year since January 1st, 2000. So we're going to talk about his career in journalism, how he began that career, and then how he made the transition from a career in journalism to this new passion of his, which is managing this database, collecting these data, organizing them, and then sharing them with the rest of the world. We're going to talk about the current state of the project, what's needed to move forward into the future, and get to know him a little bit more, which is really fascinating. He's a great storyteller and has an interesting life. He's lived a very interesting life. If you are interested in supporting Fatal Encounters, go over to fatalencounters.org, learn more about the project, and then donate. They do depend on donations, and it's very important work, so anything you can do to help would be much appreciated. If you want to help this podcast, if you find this useful, please like, follow, subscribe, whatever platform you're on. Write a review if it's on iTunes, whatever, wherever you're watching it. That really helps make sure, or listening to it, that really makes sure that more people get to check these out. So I appreciate it. And without any further ado, let's have a conversation with Brian. Hey, so thanks again for taking the time to join me. I know you're busy. You're always working. So I know your time is valuable. You're either working or you're off on some adventure.
Yeah, that's me.
So I did a brief intro before we got started and gave everyone sort of the broad strokes of who you are, but just to maybe help us get an idea of where you're coming from as a person, can you just tell us by like where you grew up? Like where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in a place called Falls City, Nebraska, which is in the southeast corner of Nebraska, and it's only famous or its main claim to fame was a movie called Boys Don't Cry. Okay. Which was about this transgender man who was killed. And he was killed by a pair of my childhood playmates. Oh, wow. Yeah, so I knew everybody who was represented in that movie. And yeah, that's pretty much my hometown.
What year was this?
What year did that happen? Guess.
Would be fine too.
I think the murder happened in probably 93. And Boys Don't Cry, I think Hilary Swank won Best Actress for it or something.
It sounds familiar. I can't remember. I'll have to check it out. So you say that that's sort of emblematic of that town. That's a little revealing. Can you maybe tell me a little bit why you feel that way?
Well, I mean, Falls City, Nebraska. Nebraska has long been one of the most conservative states in the country. The closest black person in when I was growing up lived in Hiawatha, Kansas, which was 17 miles away. No, just totally homogeneous. I'm not sure how to describe it. You know, just very rule oriented. It's like I couldn't fit in that town to save my soul. So yeah, no, they didn't tolerate dissenters too much in that town.
Were you a dissenter when you were growing up? If you don't mind me asking.
Oh yeah, I was. I totally had a problem with authority all the way through. And in fact, me becoming a journalist probably should have been, somebody should have encouraged me when I was a kid. You know, they might have gotten better success if they'd encouraged my activities towards something that was fairly, you know, positive.
And what did you do? Like, what did you do to keep busy growing up? What was there to do? And
you know, there's nothing to do. I played sports. I read just everything I could get my hands on. Listened to music. I had a job from junior high, full time most through high school. Yeah, no, it was just your typical small town Nebraska farming community upbringing.
What did your parents do? Were they working in agriculture?
No, my dad was the town doctor, and my mom was she raised us kids until I think I was about 13 when she got a job at my dad's office. But yeah, dad was, he was a country doctor, he's retired many years now. But he used to take me along on house calls. So we'd go to these crazy places out in the country. You know, if the person he was seeing had something sort of special about him, like I remember he took me to this one place, this guy had this enormous collection of Native American artifacts, you know, arrowheads and just anything you can imagine. We used to go around. It's like when our dogs got fixed, we'd go along with him to the vet, you know, and watch the operation and stuff. So obviously he was sort of engaged in us kids going into the medical profession, which none of us did. That was great, actually. It definitely sort of gave me my love of science and of numbers and of how things sort of fit together in ways that aren't necessarily narratives, words. So I was one of those people who was lucky, and I wasn't any better at English than I was at math. I was, you know, I was fairly good at both of them. But you definitely couldn't tell it by my grades, not until I got out of high school.
So you feel like you're in this sort of provincial sort of environment, I guess that's the word. Like I lived in a small town when I was a little kid too, like, and it was, you know, just a few hundred people on an island, you know, like, and I didn't see a black person until I was like 9 years old, I think, when I met the first time I met a black person, not on television,
yep,
was, you know, when I was 9 years old. So none of my relatives, you know, were interacting with black folks. It was just, it was something completely alien to me. So I can empathize with not, you know, being in like an environment where you're just not exposed to any type of diversity.
I didn't meet my first person who spoke Spanish till I was 16. I was in Scottsbluff, Nebraska. We went to a baseball game. All right, so this is probably weird for people who aren't white to hear this, but I met my first black person. We went to a Kansas City Royals baseball game, mm-hmm, and there was a little kid. He was my age, and we played through the whole game. And his name was Byron, you know, which I thought was kind of, you know, weird or something, because, you know, I'm Brian. But yeah, that was my first experience with somebody of another color, and it was we just played the whole time. There was never any sort of racial stuff. But then I'd go home to Fall City, and you would hear just the most absurd things. And of course, you know, the N word was thrown around like it was acceptable. So it was almost like training, you know, social training almost, because I had nothing to compare it to. So, you know, you're talking to these people in the barber shop or, at the fertilizer plant where I worked, or, you know, just wherever you interact with people, and they'd say all this crazy stuff. And it wasn't just, I mean, it wasn't just racist, but there was stuff like the talk about the Trilateral Commission, conspiracy thing. It's sort of like QAnon, actually.
Sounds pretty similar, actually.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the same themes, you know, racist, anti-Semite. This hidden government that's doing things with our government. Yeah, it's all, they're basically the same thing, right? except there was no, I don't recall Donald Trump being in it, and or particularly pedophiles. But, you know, I don't really know that much about QAnon, but now that I'm talking, it does sound like what I've heard about it. So, yeah, the Posse Comitatus, those people were big in southeast Nebraska. There was a preacher who had a cult down near Rulo that killed several people that got kind of famous. And I don't remember the details of that. That was after I left. Yeah. No, it was that is me. That's where I came from.
Well, I mean, that's what gives us our perspective on the world. So, like, growing up in a segregated community, as a white segregated community, it gives you an understanding of, like, if you keep your mind open to what living in, like, to if you think about it in a particular way, like, if you could just be fall into the isolation, or you could also, like, look at it critically and say, look, I'm surrounded by whiteness. And then when you meet people and you explore the world, you realize segregation is impacting white people in a negative way as well. Like,
well, and you look, I mean, we talk about our unconscious biases, and it's like, for however many years, you know, 17 years, I had my head filled with shit from people I trusted, you know, and maybe I didn't believe it. Maybe I didn't buy it at all. But it got put in there, you know. So, of course, there's unconscious biases, you know.
So you're living in this town, and you're growing up in a house where there's an expectation. Maybe you go into the medical field. What's the story on you becoming a journalist? How did that happen?
You know what? I went to a Catholic college for a bit in Atchison, Kansas, Benedictine College. And I didn't really know that I could write. I'd always read, but I didn't really know I could write. I was biochemistry, actually. I was a double major. And so this Sister Mary Faith was her name, and she basically told me that I was one of the best writers that she'd ever had as a student, and, you know, maybe I should focus on that a little bit. So I ended up moving to Nevada in 1984. So I only went to that school three semesters, I think. And, you know, again, I hadn't gotten over my trouble or my problems with authorities. So going to a Catholic college was just not a good choice for me. But they were placing 90% of their professional students. So, I mean, just great reputation for getting people into medical school. So I went to Nevada, and I was tending bar. I was a bartender in a casino in Reno for, I think I got 13 years in tending bar. Yeah. So the whole time I was going to the university, and I graduated, and well, I hadn't graduated yet. I was actually this buddy of mine. His name is Mike Norris. He would come to the bar I was working in, this casino, Eddie's Fabulous 50s, and he was the news editor or news reporter for the Reno Gazette Journal. And I was studying. I was studying English writing, which was fiction, basically. And he's going, you know, you should take some journalism classes. You like to write, blah blah. You're interested in these things. So I ended up when it came time to graduate, or, you know, that last couple semesters, and we compared my English to my journalism, and I had one more journalism class than I had English class. So I ended up graduating with a journalism degree, but then I got a master's in English writing and a master's in journalism too. So whatever, you know. So I don't use any of them now.
So the story is basically you were working in a casino, a 50s themed casino, and you were approached by a hard-boiled reporter in Nevada who convinced you to become a reporter, basically?
Exactly. That is the whole story. So then he started a newspaper called the Nevada Weekly, and this is 1993. So I was still tending bar when he started that newspaper. So he asked me to come in and do the club's grid, because in 1993 nobody knew how to use a PC. So it's like those guys were on their first. We had those Apple IIs, I think they were, you know, a little 9-inch screen or something. But none of the guys who started that paper knew how to do layout. And I had just a minimal amount of experience at the university. And so I ended up the guy who would call all the nightclubs, fill out the club's grid for what was happening. And they paid me $25 a week to do that. And then our designer quit because couldn't get along with the editor. Actually, we had like three designers quit because I couldn't get along with the editor. And finally, I got pushed into being the design.
Some of the problem was with the editor.
It might have been. That editor was Mike Norris, the guy who got me started.
Just teasing.
So I could get along with him. And so they put me in design. So I ended up designing that newspaper for the rest of its life, which was probably a year and a half after that. And then I believe we got bought out by a Sacramento paper. And I believe there were only a couple of us that they kept. I was one of them. And they kept me because I was doing both editorial writing and design of the grid, and I was designing the whole paper. So, but they get me to do sort of the back of the paper design, which was more, you know, more form than art. And then I stuck with it, and I did every job in the paper until I became the editor and publisher. Okay. So I was editor and publisher, or editor and co-publisher, when I started doing Fatal Encounters, which was in about 2012.
So let's talk about that. You're doing this. You're a reporter. You're running this paper, and then you make this. You start this project. But before we move along, so let's talk about what we're going to be talking about. It's because sometimes people will say, well, officer-involved shootings, or, you know, police-related death. There's all these different terms floating around. What does Fatal Encounters, what phenomena does it capture? Like, what are you recording?
We capture anyone who dies during an interaction with law enforcement. So it could be a suicide. It could be a third party, say a person on a bicycle who is run down during a police chase, run down not by the officer but by the person who's being pursued. I'm gonna pull up our little tagline so that we can be very clear on this. We try to document all deaths that happen when police are present or that are caused by police, on duty, off duty, criminal, line of duty, local, federal, intentional, accidental, all of them. We enable people to filter out the deaths that they aren't interested in examining. So, I mean, when we started this project, it was purely experimental. Nobody had ever done, I don't want to say nobody had ever done anything similar, because there were crowdsourcing things, but I don't believe anyone had ever done crowdsourcing on a particular issue the way that we did regarding police violence. So it was, since there wasn't any blueprint to follow, I didn't know what people were going to want to study, you know? So I sort of took direction from the arrest-related deaths program that's, you know, it was part of the Deaths in Custody Reporting Act. Actually, it had antecedents to that. But anyway, their methodology was basically exactly ours. The only thing that we collected that they didn't collect in that was off-duty deaths. And I actually, the rationale was for me and us was because often officers aren't ever off duty.
Right.
They're required to carry a gun when they're whether they have a uniform on or not. So for all practical purposes, they're on duty. So if an officer does something while they're off duty, you know, gets involved in a police-related death, the courts look at it as though they're on duty. And so do, you know, say, district attorneys who are examining it. They treat them as though they're on duty. So, again, for all practical purposes, they're on duty. So we collected them. So that sort of broadened the definition of what they were doing with the arrest-related deaths collection.
One thing, so it might be a little difficult for people to get their head around because you're saying that you're expanding this definition, and someone might say, well, if the cop didn't kill this person, how can you blame the police? You gave the example of the person, you know, riding their bicycle and being hit by the person fleeing from the officers. I went early on in my career, I had an experience like that where one of our police officers, I responded a few minutes, like not even a few minutes, like a few seconds after this happened, really, like probably less than a minute, where it was a motorcycle officer, and it was like really early in the morning, and the liquor, they were not allowed to sell booze anymore inside of the gas station, so you couldn't buy beer for a certain number of hours, you know, after a certain hour, mm-hmm. and then you couldn't till I can't remember, I don't remember the rules. So he couldn't buy beer, so a person went in and did a beer run. They grabbed some beer, and they ran out of the store and took off with the beer. And when they did this, this motorcycle officer was driving by, and he saw the guy run out and get in the car and take off with the beer. And he flipped around and lit him up with his motorcycle lights, and the guy took off, and the officer chased him for just like a couple of blocks. It wasn't like a long pursuit. But while he was chasing him, the guy who was fleeing blew through a red light and T-boned a guy who was on his way to work, and like flipped the guy's car over, and he killed the occupant. And I remember, you know, going up to the car, and it was still like a fresh accident, and the guy's, you know, really badly injured, and there's like the Snickers bar and a pack of smokes and his lunch, and he's just, you know, some guy who's just driving to work. And that wouldn't have happened if that officer hadn't, there's no way to know, of course, but it seemed pretty apparent that the reason this guy had blown through that light and killed this guy was because he was fleeing from the police. And the only thing that he was fleeing from the police for was stealing some beer, you know, like this.
Right.
And so like, it might be hard for people to get their head around, well, why are the police responsible in some way for that? But like, in my mind, like that officer, though he wasn't acting in a malicious way, he wasn't trying to kill somebody, that behavior has implications. Can you talk to me? Can you maybe give us another example of a situation where it's not the officer directly pulling the trigger, but where officer behavior or institutional behavior leads to a death?
Yeah, there was a guy in Reno who was running away from some court officers, and he went into what do you call that thing? You know where you take your garbage and you put it into the chute.
Like the garbage chute.
So he, Yeah, chute. So he was trying to hide in the chute, but he went into the trash compactor, and since it had a laser that automatically crushed whatever went through, he was crushed. So, I mean, you can't see. I don't ever blame the officer, really. I mean, that's kind of antithetical to what I think we're doing. We're just documenting. I mean, I don't really do analysis. It's like my analysis is a simple visualization that you can see on the website. There's only one, and it's got a bunch of different aspects to it. But I don't attempt to. That's just. I don't really blog about it. I only blog about this stuff when we're trying to raise money. I don't do analysis. It's like I made a decision. Very early on, that I could either collect the data so other people could figure out how it's best analyzed, or it just couldn't happen. I mean, it would. I didn't have time to do both. I didn't have time to run an organization and attempt to analyze this stuff. So we never did. So people want to study what they want to study. So maybe. People blame the officers, but that's not really what's going on, or that's not how I perceive it. I just see it as just documentarian. So anyway, no, there's all kinds of examples of people who run from officers and fall off buildings, or these chase deaths where it turns out the cop didn't even chase them. They saw them and they know that they were running from them, but they weren't chasing them. But we still have to, I mean, we still document it. And so we're not the only ones. I mean, Fatal Encounters isn't the only organization that perceives chase deaths in this way. For example, the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, I always mess that
That's
up, but I
pretty
think that's
good.
right.
That's pretty good.
They use the exact same criteria for deaths. So the person can be a third party, can be on foot, not be the person chasing, and it is still classified a police chase death. So it sort of seems like some of this stuff came from out of the blue, but mostly it had some sort of basis in how these types of deaths are studied.
So you were looking and saying, well, how are other people measuring these things? And you tried to be as encompassing as you can, and with the thought that, well, if someone wants to filter down and focus just on shootings or just on stabbings, or they can
Right.
do that. And
Yeah, we would have that information and make it available, and that's how we do it. We have a giant spreadsheet, 29,000 people who died during these fatal encounters, and people can, if they want to just look at deadly force, we have a column that's called intended use of force, so they could filter out accidental deaths or the off-duty domestic violent type deaths, or filter out the vehicles, because some people think these pursuit deaths are irrelevant. But the fact is, while 60% of the deaths are caused by gunshots, I mean that's 40% are not. You can't look at police violence, deadly police violence, and simply say, okay, we're going to stop at gunshots. That I can't think of a single other issue that where you would say, a little bit more than half of the information is enough. But because this is the way it looks in the movies, this is the way that the news media portrays it. And since some of the news media have bought into that fiction, they spend a lot of time misinforming the American public about what police violence looks like.
Right, and it's not always like George Floyd wasn't with gunshots,
Right.
and then one of the things that was remarkable for me going through just a year's worth of your data and reading accounts of all of the incidents was how many times I was reading it and found myself saying, "Oh, don't chase him. You know, like, this is not a good time to, like, a good restrictive police policies would prohibit this, you from chasing this person. So there's either a policy failure or an officer not following policy. But, like, I would just over and over see right. instances where I was like, it's not worth putting the community at risk. And I know enough about police policy to know that there are agencies around the country who've come to this conclusion, and reasonable people in law enforcement recognize that you shouldn't chase shoplifters. You shouldn't chase people just for traffic violations, because the right. risk is not worth the reward. But you see it over and over again. Is that frustrating? That must be frustrating for you.
You know, I try and sort of distance myself from what I'm looking at as much as possible. It's like I it's kind of hard to explain how I continue to do this. Because there have been a lot of people that I've worked with that can only do it for so long. It takes a certain type to sort of be able to put some distance between what you're looking at and what you're seeing and what you're typing or something. I don't know how to explain it. It just was sort of lucky that I ended up being the one who started this project.
And I want to talk a little bit about the scale of it, but before we get to the scale of the endeavor, because it's pretty remarkable what you've managed to bring into existence. This is a weird thing. Like, it's like when you meet someone who runs a mortuary, you always want to be like, so what made you, you know, what made you decide to get into this line
right.
of work? Because it's the, I think for most people, this would be really depressing, difficult work to go through incident after incident of people having the worst day of their life and repeating, you know, being exposed to it over and over again, that you think, well, there must be some circumstances, some thought, something that occurred to them, something that motivates you. For you, what's the story? So how do you explain your interest in and willingness to do this?
All right. Well,
easy question.
Its basis was a Friday night. I was driving home from work. I was the editor of the newspaper, and I saw this scene of chaos. More police cars than I'd ever seen anywhere off the police parking lot. And I just knew that somebody had either killed a cop or been killed by a cop. From the nature of way, you know, the cars were parked haphazard, and this neighborhood was kind of cordoned off. And it just sparked a curiosity. So I went home, I cracked a bottle of red wine, that cheap Costco red wine, and I started researching, because how often does that happen? I mean, that was really the question. So how often does the government kill somebody? And that's sort of how I framed it in my head. So I discovered pretty quickly that there weren't any real, I don't want to say nobody knew, but I discovered pretty quickly that people had only the vaguest idea. So at the time, the instrument that most people use to track this were the supplementary homicide reports, which is part of the Uniform Crime Report collected by the FBI. And now I'm going to truncate like 6 months worth of work into just a couple sentences. But basically, I got the document that was 1998 through 2012 of the supplementary homicide reports. And because I have a bias against Florida,
we all have a bias against
Florida. I don't know where that came from, though. But anyway, it seems like crazy stuff happens in Florida all the time. So I knew that if I went to Florida, the numbers were just going to be insane. But it turned out that Florida was the one state that had never participated in the supplementary homicide report. So according to the FBI, no law enforcement officer had ever killed anyone in the state of Florida. And it was like a light bulb went off, because in my research, I could see every year, you know, they'd say at the beginning of the year, they'd say, when they released the new SHR, they'd say, okay, 2 years ago, they killed 385 people, or law enforcement killed 385 people in the United States. And every year that number would be repeated as though it were true. But when I actually saw what the numbers were and that they didn't include the state of Florida, it was like a light bulb went off. And I realized that, I realized that we were being lied to. Maybe not lied to, but misled. So these reporters in national media would parrot those numbers as though they were true, and people would believe them as though they were true. And the FBI would never say, oh, you know, that's not really true because, you know, we only collect 40% of the deaths. So I was offended.
You're a little pissed off by it.
I was offended on a lot of levels. I grew up in Falls City, Nebraska, where you're taught if the government says it, it's the truth. I mean, that's part of that whole conservative upbringing. But as a journalist, as you know, by that time I was what 20 years into, or maybe not 20 years, about 20 years into it. I sort of believe journalists too. So these two groups that I was taught to believe from the time I was, you know, whatever, a child, that I could believe, turned out both to be lying to me about one of the most important things about how our government interacts with people. You know, the media is supposed to keep an eye on the government. The government is supposed to be benevolent and not kill people, you know, and then say it didn't, or, you know, kill people unnecessarily, or, you know, pick your thing. Man, I feel like as I look in this camera, I look sort of crazy because my eyes keep rolling.
Sorry. You look fine to me.
Anyway, I offended is the only word that really works. So I decided at that time that I would figure out how many people were killed by police in a year, was basically what I was thinking. And really what I was thinking was I was going to put a name on all that anonymized data in the SHR, which proved to be impossible because for various reasons. But in the meantime, I was collecting data. I was collecting it on sort of a day-by-day basis and doing monthly updates. But I also had this spreadsheet that volunteers would work with. You know, it was open for anyone to edit, and I never had a problem until Ferguson happened. So when Ferguson happened, I developed a little notoriety because I was the only person in the world with a year's worth of data about people who get killed by police or people who die during interactions with police. So I did a story for Gawker, and it got... It was one Gawker, which at the time was one of the most popular websites. It was one of the top 100 stories they ever produced. So at that time, there were 100,000 people trying to work on that Google spreadsheet. Literally, wow. No exaggeration. And so at least a couple of them were trolls.
Oh, no.
So they would pull a single cell out, or 100 cells. You know, you couldn't tell. That would maybe put the city in the wrong state, or, you know, these they would just destroy the spreadsheet with the snap of a finger.
Did you ever get any indication what would motivate somebody to do, like, because you're trying to create a database of people that are being killed by the state? Was there ever any indication what would motivate someone to do that, or?
No, I think people are just, you know, they can be
just people. Takes a handful, I guess.
You know, it only would have taken one to destroy the work of all those people. I mean, seriously. So anyway, I mean, that day, the day that story came out, I had to change our methodology a little bit. So instead of having the spreadsheet that they could work on, I made a Google form by which they could look at the spreadsheet and fill out the information. And it was fine. But I mean, we lost, I just can't tell you how much work we lost in that first basically 12 hours. But it was epic. It was this epic battle against the trolls, you know, trying to every time I'd see something bad had happened, I would have to revert to the last saved version of the spreadsheet before they messed something up. It was crazy.
That's terrible. That's really disappointing. I hadn't heard that story. That's terrible.
Well, you know, literally, if we'd been able to keep that going, we could have done the whole Fatal Encounters project in a matter of days instead of a matter of years. But there was nothing to be done. You know, it had never been done. So how would I know that there would be, you know, bad actors, so to speak?
But
on the other hand,
you could have accomplished the work at an exponential rate because of all this attention if only but a handful of bad actors hadn't interfered and ruined it for everybody.
If I had known just 24 hours in advance that a single person would be doing that, I mean, I've been thinking about that Google form for a long time. And I guess if I weren't so naive, you know, I would have done it that way. But
I don't think that's your fault. I think that's just a terrible story that just took a little piece of my faith in humanity away.
Yeah, it was awful, and it was so amazing. I mean, it was so gratifying to see, you know, at the top of the Google sheet, it's got those little icons of people are on it, and you'd see, you know, the five little animals and then plus 100 or, you know, whatever the limits of the sheet were at that time. And it would be full up just constantly. It was amazing. It was amazing.
Right. I'm sorry that, well, it's amazing. And it's like one of those Greek tragedies, I guess.
It was epic. That's what makes it epic.
You're talking about a huge project. Can you just give us an idea of, like, and I know this is out there, but just to give the listener an idea of, like, how, so you're going from the year 2000 all the way up to today. Can you talk about, like, how many cases is that across a year? How many total, and how long, like, how many human hours would you estimate have been spent in creating this?
Okay. Well, you know, I did that math for somebody recently. I might be able to find it real quick. Right now we're at 28,828 incidents. So I'm going to go look for that Twitter response. Okay. Because, you know, I don't even think of it that way because,
tell me how you think of it in terms of, if you had to quantify it for people, tell me how many, like, what is this?
It's a part-time job. You know, I work doing the daily collection, only takes me a couple hours every day. But I do so many other projects, you know, and I work for USC on related research. And I don't know. It's just really hard to put into numbers.
Basically, it's become part of your life. Was that fair to say, like, part of your everyday life?
It's sort of my job. I mean, I'm only going to do it until somebody else does it better. And I think we're on the verge of that. I feel like AI might be able to do that I keep saying next year, but I think we're there now. I think that if some large organization chose to take this on, that I could be made obsolete in a matter of days.
What type of an organization are you talking about? Like, could you give me some examples of what type of an organization Google, could do this?
Google, Microsoft, you know, somebody who works with AI, IBM, any of those large organizations that, you know, that do cloud AI.
So you think that if a Google said tomorrow, you know, we want to take this on as a project and we want to document every person who dies, every police related death in the United States, that they could set up a system and it could do a superior job of capturing these data and do a more thorough job?
Yes. I think they could do it quicker with less human interaction. So there are things that we aren't capturing that I used to believe couldn't be captured, but I've sort of like non-fatal gunshots. I think in the last few years, the number of times that's reported compared to, you know, the few years before, it's exponential. You know, it's being reported a lot more, so we could probably get pretty close to, you know, 70 or 80%. It would be a lot. And I'm sorry, I'm not finding my.
Don't worry about it. I'm sorry. don't worry about it. It was just me wanting to quantify something, and I think what you just described does a better job of giving us an idea what this means. We're talking about like a something that the federal government should be doing, something that a large institution should be doing, but because of this lack of, this doesn't exist, you've basically filled the gap and created this space and this organization to carry out this what should be a basic responsibility of the state, right?
Right. I found it.
Okay.
So the spreadsheet has 2,658,328 words in it. The New American Standard Bible only has 782,815 words. So what is that? That's roughly four times the size of the Bible.
And that's just people, small accounts of people, like short narratives and basic variables of people that have died in the presence of police in this country.
Yeah. Who, what, where, when, where? Who, what, where, when, how, and why? Okay. That's all it is. And I try to keep the short descriptions under 100 words. So there you go. But 29,000. So I see in this thing, I said it's been more than a full-time job. The actual collection of the data is not. I mean, I'm usually done with that part by noon. So I get my Google alerts at 8 o'clock in the morning, and it's usually done by noon. But then there's all these other things that I have to do, you know, that are related but aren't necessarily it. Like I'm in the middle of website redesign and design of a new website and some groups I work with. It just, you know, it takes full-time job worth of time.
Have you, given what's been happening in this, I've seen you in other interviews where you've talked about this as being sort of episodic, where you get attention and then things cool down a little bit and you get more attention. Like if there's an incident, and recently with the George Floyd murder, you have received some more attention. Has there been, because it sounds like the help of one of these tech firms could be, and they have like all the money, seems like something that they could step up and give you assistance with. Have there been any moves from them to help you?
Yeah, there are, but I can't really talk about it right now. But yeah, I'm definitely talking with somebody who's got an idea, and it sounds amazing.
So we don't need to go raise hell on your behalf to convince
Google. No, don't raise any. Okay. No, it's, you know, it's, and now it's almost, easy isn't the right word. The actual research, looking up finding the names, the addresses, you know, doing the geolocation, that stuff, it's easy. it's just tedious now, you know? So, I mean, taking it up to whatever the next level might be, is really sort of the thing pulling me forward right now, because the rest I could do with my eyes tied behind my back.
So you've got the process now. It's just about streamlining it and making it more efficient. And that's where the technology can. And one thing I heard you talk about was, expanding this to, because a lot of times when police officers discharge a firearm, it doesn't kill somebody. It wounds them or they miss. But a decision was made by the state to deploy lethal force against a civilian. That's a pretty remarkable event. And it makes sense that we would record all of those instances. And you were talking about how those are becoming more, they're more likely to be reported nowadays than in the past. Now, what I'm assuming that's because there are just more outlets. There's more attention being paid to this topic. The internet. How would you explain the change? And then B can you talk about the reliability of the data from like 2001, 2002 compared to like 2017, 2018 data in the database?
Yeah. Well. Okay, so you have to sort of think back to what things were like in 2000. I mean, there was an internet, but it was not what it is now. A lot of newspapers weren't on it. Those that were primarily using local servers. So really, I mean, even the newspaper I worked for would purge older stuff, and on even larger ones, that there was just things would have a sell by date sort of, so that data would just go away, you know. They'd keep whatever their servers could hold, and then what was older than that just went away. So a lot of the data, when we were searching in 2013 for 2000, had already gone. So I don't know what's missing. There's no way of knowing. But nowadays, particularly after 2007, when cloud computing started, or I guess 2006 maybe, so large organizations were able to keep all their stories, all their data, all their videos, all their photographs, all their documents, everything. So I don't know. You just can't know if the increase is because of increased police violence, which of course you would predict, considering the fact that we got into two wars after, you know, January 1, 2000. So those veterans are coming home sort of with muscle memory about where to shoot somebody if they want to kill them. But they're also getting things like, you know, militarized weapons. You know, there are things that make it look, well, that I'm convinced means the amount of violence has increased. But as far as the data goes, we don't know what percentage of that is because of the increase in violence and what is because of the increase in missingness or in losing that old data. But I can tell you when we have a link to every story or every incident that we have in the records. So those links and those organizations, those drop off at the drop of a hat. I mean, it's amazing how short-lived those things are. So the links go rotten, but sometimes you can look at the link and then go to the Internet Archive, the Wayback Machine, and find the story, and then you just print it out and link to that. But we don't know the answer to how much is lacking from the early days. There's no way to know.
And it just highlights the need for the database, because you basically are saying that because of these things that are happening in the world, you would expect there to be an increase in police violence because of these wars and, you know, other things taking place. But the fact that we don't have a database we can't know that if that's happening, or you know, to what type of
influence it's having. Yeah, well, moving forward, that's true. I mean, prior to say 2010, I think that's where the missingness has more of an effect. Doing it in real time, I don't think we're losing anything. You know, if we are, it's because police agencies don't tell the media if they killed somebody, and that happens sometimes. I think it was Tucson. I saw this quote that said, "Well, we haven't had a policy to release that data," which is the same as saying we're just, you know, we have a policy not to. And I was actually a little shocked to see that. But there's some of that. I can't imagine that we're missing, you know, 2%. I mean, it's a very small number, but there's got to be some out there that were never reported. There has to be.
I would think earlier on there would be a lot that got missed, but nowadays with just the internet, every jurisdiction has some type, several people that are going to be recording what's happening, and I'm sure some will slip through the cracks, but I can't imagine it's very many. So I think I like the crowdsourcing idea. I think is a great way to go about it, to be honest.
Well, yeah, but we don't really do crowdsourcing anymore. That turned out to just, so we sort of had three methods of data collection. We started out, the project was going to be public records requests, crowdsourced public records requests. And we had a little bit of success with that. I think we made 2,500 public records requests. But, you know, it's expensive and it's slow. And to get it 18,000 jurisdictions, it was just, you know, it was an experiment. The whole thing has been an experiment. So we tried that, and we had the crowdsourcing, and the crowdsourcing worked for a couple months after you know, the Michael Brown incident. But once we got some notoriety, the most effective way of doing it was to pay researchers to do the sort of historic stuff. So we were paying people $3.50 a record. And then they would put that up on, you know, on a separate spreadsheet, and then I would fact check it, which not really fact check it, but just verify it against the media reports to make sure that what we put on the spreadsheet was what it actually said, you know, just because people make errors, you know, just coding errors. So and then now, unless we're working on a specific, like right now, a couple months ago, we had a crowdfunding campaign because we wanted to collect data on, we call it threat assessment. So we're collecting four additional columns, and hopefully we'll have at least 5 years worth of data by the end of this year. So it's, was the person armed or unarmed? What was the alleged weapon? Was there physical movement? Like you see in these stories, they, you know, they reached to their belt, or they extended their arm, or, you know, they brandished a weapon, or all these weird little, you know, very specific things that appear in news stories. And were they fleeing or not fleeing? You know, for obvious reasons. So we expect to have those 5 years worth of those by the end of this year, and then we'll continue doing it. So anyway, it's just easiest to have a couple people who work on it at a time. And there's just no reason to do the crowdsourcing because the crowd isn't trained, right. You know?
So it's not crowdsourcing, it's more like scouring the internet for these accounts and then having.
Okay. So my thing is, so I do the basic daily updates. So I think I had 26 Google alerts at 8 o'clock this morning. So I've got like 50 that go to multiple email accounts because sometimes Google alerts don't work. I mean, it's so weird because it seems like it would be something that's just automated, but it's not. So sometimes they'll work on one account, not the other. But, you know, when they're forwarded to my account, if they come from multiple accounts, it just looks like one, you know. That probably doesn't explain it very well, but so anyway, I have multiple things that are just obvious phrases that appear in stories regarding people who get killed by police, like officer involved shooting, or taser died, or stun gun died, or suspect drowned, or police chase. Deputy chase, trooper chase, you know, or trooper chase or pursuit, you know, just anything you can imagine. Duty weapon killed, or administrative leave, standard administrative leave. Because every story that where somebody gets killed, not everyone, but many stories where somebody gets killed, those words appear. And they aren't always together, but, you know, you get the idea. So I just go through those, and it really just doesn't take very long to do it now.
So are you generating the narrative yourself now for each of the incidents?
Yeah, but generally speaking, the brief description, I try not to type anything. It's like I will copy a nut graph and then modify it, you know, because they don't like to call people by their name in the beginning. They like to call them a suspect or something, you know. So I will modify it to get in the very most basic facts that will enable people. And these aren't researchers like, you know, PhD candidates. These are just people who go onto the Fatal Encounters website and want to research, you know, maybe their hometown. Mm-hmm. So these descriptions give the most basic facts. And if it's, say, the address I wouldn't include the address in the short description, for example, because it's already in the rest of the document. So I try to type as little as possible. I try to think about it as little as possible. I know that sounds weird, but that's sort of how I keep doing it, I think.
No, it makes sense. Well, I don't think you could go through, you know, almost doing, you know, like 1,800 or so cases a year and write little narratives about people dying and not go a little crazy unless you detach yourself from the work a little bit. I think you see the same thing with the cops. They become a little cold and distant, and they look at the people as sort of just part of their work product after a while as a way to deal with, you know, like the nurses, you know, if you're an ER nurse, I think you do the same sort of thing. It's a managing traumatic incidents. There's a way that you do it, and sometimes it's making it so that you have a little distance. So I think that's perfectly – makes a lot of sense that's how
– So – somebody who's working for the Bureau of Justice Statistics told me that people who are working with similar data were only allowed to work on it 4 hours a day.
Yeah, I know. I can see why. I mean, just the time I spend going through them, I'm like, you know, you read some of them, and then every once in a while you'll go down a little. I have a terrible tendency to go down like the rabbit hole on them where I'll
me too.
You know, I read all the things, and then I'm like, oh, I wonder if a lawsuit got filed, and then I'll follow them through, and then the ones where you're like, oh, this is shitty, this shouldn't have happened, or, you know, and it's not like, very rarely am I like, oh, these officers are terrible human beings. It's usually like, this guy freaked out and shot this guy, or, you know, he was doing, this is stupid, you know, so it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, one thing you find out from the research is the vast majority of these are good guy against bad guy, good guy protecting himself or protecting someone else. And that's the vast majority of them. But then there's the ones where you get a sense that there's a story not being told. you see certain things that are just sort of that are impossible to believe, you know. And those ones are the ones that, you know, that should get a public airing. But in many cases, those are the ones that get hidden. And that is what creates frustration in so many cities, you know, is if law enforcement were just honest, if the media was just honest, if, you know, whomever was just honest and let the facts come out, then people can judge you on the facts, and people shouldn't be afraid to be judged on the facts. But so many, I don't know, administrators or bureaucrats are just afraid of actual people, are afraid of the public looking at them, that they think they'll be prejudged, so they prejudge everybody else. And I mean, the stuff we're seeing in the United States right now is a direct result of these situations being hidden, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think this is, I think video has done a lot to expose the American public to the realities of what's happening with the security forces here in this country. So, like, I keep going back to the George Floyd thing, but if George Floyd had been killed 8 years earlier, then there wouldn't have been a smartphone, there wouldn't have been a video recording, and what it probably would have been is a couple of citizens saying they saw these officer kneeling across his neck, and the officer saying, no, it was on his shoulder, and then it would have been the toxicology report, and they would have said, well, it's like excited delirium or acute, you know, overdose of this drug, blah, blah, blah. But because now you have a video of it, then regular folks, it can't just be swept under the rug as easily.
Right.
One thing I will say is that I have noticed is it's alarming to me when I see an incident where a person is killed by the police and there's three news reports the day or the next day saying police killed somebody, police say this, report will follow, more will follow, we'll follow the story, and then there's nothing after it, there's no follow-up, and
right.
Very rarely do you see like a journalist get at one of these deaths and go in and talk about the person, their family, the circumstances, what led to it, history with the department, like really reporting on what led to that death. When you do see it, it's like, it's fantastic. I really appreciate it. There are still great journalists out there.
Sure.
So I don't want to take up too much of your time. I just got two more questions for you, and then I'll get you on your way. I know you got another meeting. So this has been received, I'm assuming, very well. Like, I'm sure we've received a lot of appreciation from the various communities around the country, maybe probably around the world. I've seen lots of people say nice things about you and what you're doing. Have you had any negative feedback? Have you had any kickback?
Sure. Yeah, I used to get death threats. I used to get quite a few death threats, actually. But that has cooled down. In fact, it's probably been more than a year since I had one. One of the last ones was one of the weirder ones where they were taking pictures of my house and sending it to me, with some oddly sort of homoerotic messages.
Is there some sort of strain of logic floating through, like what they find the problem?
I think people are more likely to say that I'm causing all this stuff that's going on with the data. In fact, I've seen that, but not really attached with the threat of violence to it lately. But yeah, I got an email last week that said basically that.
That you're causing problems, you know, by reporting on what's happening, basically?
Yeah. Yeah. I am the root of this problem.
Okay. Well, if we just get rid of you, everything will be great.
Yeah, don't say that, man.
I'm totally kidding. No, we need you for sure. You're doing great work, so we need to keep you around. So before I really appreciate your time. Before I let you go, just one last question is, there's a lot of people who are motivated to do something right now. They feel as though that this is an important issue, and they want to contribute in one way or another. Is there any way, if somebody wants to help with your work that you're doing, what's the best thing that they can do to help advance that work?
You know, you disappeared through half of that. So I think you asked me if there's a way people can help.
Yeah, how they can help you and advance this research. What can they do?
Oh, well, we can always use more money. You know, every nickel of it goes to the research. If they want to volunteer, you know, I can usually find ways. But nowadays, the volunteering is more technical. Like if people can do visualizations, I like people like that. We do have the ongoing columns where we're doing the threat assessment. So I'm still hiring and training people for that. Just contact me through the website and we'll think of something.
Okay, so if you don't have
mapping is also very popular.
If you've got some of those like special skills, reach out, and if you can't afford a few bucks, then reach out and you can find a way to help out using your
absolutely
name. But if you can and you can skip that that Starbucks on the way to the office and send $5, all that money is going to go to help collecting data on that, and then those data are going to be used to do research, and that research is then used to draft policy and restrict use of force and could save lives.
We hope, you know. I mean, that was the idea. It's not just I don't believe it's just the people being killed by police that this helps. I think it helps. I think it helps the police. I believe a lot of what happens now in these interactions is because of fear. So because of everything that's happening in the country and in the media and on TV, you know, makes officers more suspicious of the people around them, and it makes people more suspicious of officers, and people are more likely to act in ways that are, you know, panic-based. People are more likely to run, I think, because they're afraid. So, you know, that fight or flee mechanism in us is below the level of consciousness.
Right.
So people don't know why they're running. They're running because their hormones said, run. I think if people understood what was going on a little better, there would probably be fewer deaths just on that level. Just on that level. I'm not talking, you know, people shooting at cops or cops shooting at people. I just mean better interpersonal relationships.
So I want to thank you again for your time. Do you have any final words for the audience? Leave it this way. We're heading into this. It feels like this is a decisive moment, like right now, like with the this election and the crisis in these cities. Is there anything that you think that we should be doing? Is there any sort of like thing that stands out to you? Want to leave like any parting thoughts?
Yeah, I would like to say that police are killing people at unprecedented levels this year. I mean, it's going to be at least 15% above our highest level, which was 2 years ago. So I don't know. I think eventually we're going to have to move from questions of protest to questions of policy.
That's a great way to leave it. Thank you again, and look forward to our
I wish my voice hadn't cracked on that.
No, I think it was perfectly delivered. Thank you so much.
Okay, good.